two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, more importantly, about recovery, brought to you by our friends at useonlyisdirected.org. They got a three-part solution: speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. We got Chris Jones here. In the first episode, we talked about his beginning going down the road to his drug addiction, and we found out he'd been to 12 recovery centers over how many years?
It would have been over about 16 years.
Wow. And your family was along the ride the whole time?
I honestly can't say enough. I wouldn't be here without them. I mean, if they'd given up on me at any point, I would have been done. And not one point did they ever say, you're off. You're out on the streets, like, ever. And I'd still, to this day, don't know how that happened. But it was just loyalty and love that they consistently always showed.
Which is amazing. I mean, so many people don't realize how important family and friends like that are. But did they set limits? I mean, did they? Do you feel like they enabled that for 15 years, or do you feel like they did set limits in their own way?
You know, I think the limits came when it was time to go to rehab. You know, there was definitely enabling, 100%. I feel like a little bit of guilt saying that in a way, because I feel like I'm passing the buck. But just by the definition of the term, I mean, yeah, there was.
But I think there always is some enabling. I mean, if you love someone and you care about them, and it's hard not to at some point be an enabler yourself. But it sounds like eventually they would kind of say, you got to do this.
Right. And it was completely out of love. It was me not wanting, or them not wanting to see me have to go out and do something really drastic on the street and, like, do something in that situation.
But to be fair to your parents and fair to you, they were doing what they thought was best, and they only know what they know.
Absolutely.
And so they were doing what they could. What does your rock bottom look like?
Well, I mean, I think you kind of brought it up in the beginning as far as the arms situation. And would have been 2013 going in, you know, and about, I'd say, 6 years into using. Back in Chicago, I mean, it's different out here, but back in Chicago, it's powder heroin. It's like they call White China, even though it's from Afghanistan, but they call it that, and it's powder form. So you can sniff it. Like out here, you know, it's like the black tar where you can smoke it or shoot it, and I don't really know the other ways, but I think that's essentially it. So for the first 6-7 years I was sniffing it, and then I actually had to go to rehab before. And my issue is I have deep veins, so I have bad veins. Like, I even when I was a kid going to try to get blood, they couldn't get it. It was just, you know, squishy deep veins. So I had tried a few times to inject it, because, you know, everybody told me, like, you need to try this because it is a whole different type of experience, a whole, like, you know, it's another level. And I went and I would try it, and it just, you know, it wouldn't work. I couldn't get it. So I just went back to what I knew. And finally I went to a rehab, met a kid there. He kind of was, you know, like a street doctor in that sense, where, like, he knew every little cheat and every little, like, way around it. And he finally showed me. I got into that for a few years, and then what happened was because of my because of the vein situation, I started doing like intermuscular instead of intravenous and what they call skin popping. So basically, you just stick it into your arm or wherever, you stick it into muscle and just shoot it, and then you start to like, you still get a high from it. It's not quite the same, but I would lose my veins so quickly, then I'd immediately go to like the skin popping situation. And what would happen was, when you would do it, it would like a little, about the size of your pinky nail, like a little spot would pop up and it would look like a bruise. And then eventually that would heal, like that would not, well, it wouldn't heal, but it would like get, it would die because it was just the skin, and I would continue to hit that spot and then it would like die off. And for the first few times I went to, I got to a point where you can't see it obviously here, but I always use them as a, you know, visual aid. My arms, they started to get black, where it was just like kind of like black, I don't know, crocodile skin. And it would just get, it went all the way around my arm, underneath, up to the top, both sides. And finally, I don't remember exactly how it happened, what the situation was, but I was wearing a sweatshirt in July, you know, and I'm wearing sweatshirts, and my arms, like, they started to smell because it was just necrotic, yeah, dead skin.
Right, yeah.
And then I think what happened was my mom saw it or something. Like, I couldn't hide it anymore. And she was like, you know, obviously she was like hysterical. She's like, what the hell is that? And then I went to the hospital for the first time. I went to Loyola in Chicago. It was to the burn unit. And I saw this doctor, I can't remember his name, but he debrided it for me. So this was like the first time I went, and it wasn't too bad. I mean, it was bad, but like they were able to just debride it, take off the top layer. It healed over. It took a few months, and then I immediately went back to it. I got clean for a little bit. I started shooting again in the same situation. That happened one more time, and then after the second time is when it got really bad, because I started going, instead of doing both arms, I started using just my left arm. And eventually, like, what happened was I couldn't, because I'd already lost like a good portion of my arm from the debridement, it was just like going into like deeper and deeper flesh. And I started losing the ability to use my left hand. And I got to a point where I was debriding it myself, where I was just using like an X-Acto knife just to kind of cut chunks out to get to fresh flesh. And then it was like, that would start to die. And then I got to a point where it was like my tendons had stopped functioning. So I was, and they'd gotten to like a consistency of, say, like beef jerky or something like that. So I was pulling out, a few times I pulled out a full tendon that was like dead for all intents and purposes. Like it was just completely gone, and I was just pulling it out. And my hand started to get like a claw, basically, because I didn't have any of the extender tendons. I only had the flexors. So that got like, it would just get worse and worse. And then, you know, I'd start to get these really bad pains in my arm because like a deep nerve would be exposed. And it was like the most brutal pain you can imagine. Like it would just touch the side of like a piece of clothing, and it would just be like the most, like the shooting pain. And then what I would do, I would just shoot there and kill that area off and continue to go down further and further until I got to my bone, basically. And it was just, it was essentially dead. Almost my whole arm. I mean, basically the whole top part of it was just black. And, finally, I think again, I don't remember exactly how it went, but you know, I was like, I need to go. And, you know, it got to a point where probably a couple months before I finally went in the hospital for the last time, like I was fully aware because of the previous experiences and because of the doctor telling me, he's like, you're going to lose your arm. You know, it's going to, like, you can't continue to do this. And I probably went another year from the second time to the last time. I went a year between hospital stays of continuously doing it. And I got to a point where I was having to use like every 15 minutes just to control the anxiety of knowing I was going to lose my arm. And I just would, you know, continue hitting those spots. And it almost became, like the doctor said, it almost became like my entire arm became a vein. where like it didn't matter where I did it, it would just, it would still function. It would still work. And I got, then eventually it started to smell so badly that I, and then my hand was so like clawed that I couldn't, you know, I wasn't really hiding it anyway, but I finally broke down and my mom saw it. And then, you know, eventually, and go back a little bit, I was almost arrested once on the south side picking up at like, I don't know, it was a couple, it was like 1 a.m. or something. And the cop pulled over and he, you know, he saw I was in a sweatshirt and it was, you know, in the summertime again. And he saw that it was like, there was like blood and he like, pull your sleeve up. And he saw it. And this is like, this is a cop on the south side of Chicago. So a guy who's seen, you know, he's
not the nice side of south side.
Right.
No, the other side.
Yeah. This is the Chirac part of Chicago. He saw it and, you know, he was blown away. He like called up his partner. He's like, man, you got to see this. Another cop pulled up and they like pulled me out and they were showing it off and you're going to die. You're going to lose that arm, you know? And I was like, yeah, I know. And he let me go because of that. Like, he's like, I'm not even going to, he just took everything and threw it down the drain. He's like, you're already punished.
You shocked him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like,
there's nothing we're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you know, what it was. And then, it was a few months after that that I finally went to the hospital. I got in, went to the hospital, finally to the Loyola again. Actually, because the second to last time I went into the hospital, the doctor basically told me, he's like, don't come back because I'm not going to help you again. Like, because if you come back again, I can't do anything for you.
And so that's a question I have, like, not to throw those docs under the bus at all, but did they urge you, try to refer you, try to get you into some treatment? They obviously knew why your arm was necrotic. So, like, what was there? Eventually, I guess they got frustrated with you and said, don't come back. But, like, before that, what were they trying to do for you?
I mean, you know, I'd go through detox while I was there because of the fact that I had an infection in my body. So, like, they would kind of detox me while I was in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I'd get through it and then I'd say everything. I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to rehab. I'm going to IOP.
Yeah.
Whatever. But I was basically just going there just as like a pit stop just to get it cleaned off, you know, and then go back out.
So the third time you went back?
The third time I went back, I had to go to two different hospitals, three different hospitals. I went to two first and initially, you know, they told me immediately, they're like, we're taking your arm from the elbow. Like, there's no way we can save it. Like, the first hospital I went, they were just pouring peroxide on my, like, literally pouring it. And they're like, we're taking, you know, you're going. So I'm like, no, I wouldn't accept it. And then I went to another one, so told me the same thing. Finally, I went back to Loyola because they do have a great burn program. And I was like, this is my last ditch effort, like Hail Mary. And I went there and I went in, talked to the doctor, and, you know, at this point, I'm like 120 pounds. I weigh 120 pounds. I'm like ashen gray. I have osteomyelitis, which, you know, I find out. I have a blood infection that was the main reason why they wanted to amputate, because they were so afraid of it getting to my heart.
Yeah.
And that's what they were so, you know, that was their main concern about getting me in and starting to treat me. And finally, the doctor that had actually told me not to come back, he comes down and sees me in the ER and he's like, I know I told you not to come back. And he's like, I'm not saying this to like, is some kind of vendetta or anything like that. He's like, I want to help you, but I can't do anything. He's like, it's too far gone. There's nothing I can do to help you in any way. And so at this point I was kind of like resigned to, I was like, all right, you know, I'm losing my arm. That's it. Like, I can't do anything about it. And so I'm sitting there and they have me in the ICU because of the fact that I'm in such bad shape and they're just trying to get me physically healthy enough to do something, you know. And then they put me up in the room and the night before I'm supposed to go in, you know, I remember breaking down and just like begging him, like, is there anything you can do? Like, anything at all? Like, please help me. He's like, you know, the only thing I can think of is I can try to get the plastic surgeon, and his name's Dr. Van Dievender, who's, you know, like my saving grace. And he comes in And this is midnight, the night before. I'm scheduled for surgery the next morning at 6 a.m. to have my arm removed. They came in to, you know, the robotic came in, like, to give me, like, a, you know, they were going to give me, like, a prosthetic arm. And they came in and, like, did measurements and everything. And so he comes in the night I broke down and, like, begged. And finally he's like, that's the only thing I can think of. So he brings the plastic surgeon in. He runs all these tests at, like I said, it was about midnight the night before. And he does all these, you know, he checks, he takes some pictures, and he's like, I don't know. He's like, I've never seen anything like this, you know? And I don't know if there's anything I can do. And he's like, I just don't know. And then what I'd found out after I'd been in the hospital for some time was he actually didn't sleep that night. And he called in at about, like, I don't know, 5 in the morning or something to cancel the surgery. And I didn't find out until I was being wheeled into the OR room, and like that I went in, and instead of, instead of the amputation, they were going to do a debridement. I found out as I was being rolled in there, and he told me after I'd been in the hospital for a while that he wasn't sure, and he wasn't sure all night and stayed up all night wondering if he should even try it, if it would even be, like, medically responsible to give it a shot because of the fact of all the, like, the infection I had throughout my body. And he, like I said, he called in, like, literally, like, at the last second was like, we're going to change it, we're going to try. So they did a debridement, like, the first of 5 debridement surgeries. And so I was in the hospital at that point. I've been there for just a few days. I ended up being in there for just over 2 months, and they did a total of 7 surgeries. And they did 5 debridement surgeries,
is where they're going in
and just
taking the dead skin,
all
the
cutting
dead
skin
it
all
out,
off, cutting yeah. everything out. They had to do that 5 different times. Wow.
I remember the first one only because instead of fully putting me under, they did a nerve block, mm-hmm. and they, like, did Twilight. So I have this, like, vague memory of sitting there and, like, feeling my shoulder being moved around while they were, like,
scraping it.
Yeah.
Away. Wow.
And, and then what they would do is they'd put this wound vac on my arm, which is like a black sponge that they would put on it and then just wrap it in that Teflex, whatever that stuff is, you know, that suction stuff. And then I'd remember those situations, and I would, like, when they would take those off, they'd usually take them off during surgery, but a few times they didn't. And it was, like, the most painful experience I've ever had in my life, because they're, like, ripping it off as, like, all this new skin and everything and, like, stuff is healing on there.
And so they did the 5 surgeries there. Then the plastic surgeon came in, mm-hmm. and kind of did some work on your arm, because your arms look...
Yeah, no, they're... I mean, that's the thing. Like, sometimes I'm not, like, cognizant of it, but, like, they obviously do look different. But, like, as far as what they did look like and what he did, because what he did was he took a free flap from my thigh, so, like, a big football-shaped chunk from my thigh. It was, like, a 3/4-inch chunk, and reconnected it to my arm. And, you know, when he did that, it was... He could only find one little vein in there, one little baby vein that, like, and they had to check it every 5 minutes when they did it just to make sure it was taking. And, you know, I was sitting in the ICU, like, when that was happening, and it was a miracle. Like, it really was a miracle. Like, I think about it, and like I said, I'm not dismissive of it in any way, but I just sometimes, like, you know, just kind of, you know, day to day, you don't constantly think about it. But when I do sit back and, like you said, the video, and, like, it just kind of brings it home a lot more, where I'm like, it is amazing that I even am able to do anything, you know. And, like, the fact that I have, like, I'd say I probably have 85% of, like, dexterity with my left arm. I mean, my right arm's pretty much normal.
So you spend 2 months in the hospital, mm-hmm. 5 debridement surgeries, a couple times with a plastic surgeon. That's probably the longest time you've been sober in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where your recovery began?
No. So
we're going to find out about that in just a few seconds right here on Project Recovery.
Hi. 2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at KSLPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
After all the surgeries, it doesn't stop there?
No, it doesn't.
Are you insane?
Yes. Yes, I am. And just as an example of that...
it's crazy, right?
After...
I mean, we talk
I thought
a
we
lot.
Were getting to the end of this.
We talk a lot about how powerfully delusional the addict brain is. And this, Chris, this story of yours... I mean, just drives it home. Here, I mean, you know, you're going into surgery thinking you're going to lose your arm, and then you end up staying for 2 months and have all these painful surgeries and still no rock bottom.
No, and like I said, just as an example of that is like what they had to do, they had to put in a deep vein stent under my bicep just because they couldn't, I didn't have any veins anyway, so they were... Just to get all my IVs and everything, they had to do that, you know, which where they just take the ultrasound thing and find it and loop it down into your heart. And when I was leaving, I had convinced, because after the hospital, I had to take heavy antibiotics, vancomycin, like this real heavy antibiotic just to keep myself, you know, level and I wouldn't get any infections because I was so susceptible to it. I would have to take that for another month or two, and they were giving me injections of it. And I had actually convinced all the doctors, except the last one who finally came in, but I'd convinced them to allow me to keep like a direct line to my heart. And I'd taken a few syringes, you know, it's the kind you have to screw on to the,
right,
you know, and I'd they were in my drawer next to my bed. And like a few days before I was leaving, I snagged a few and I was going to bring them with me. And then finally the doctor came in. He's like, do you know why he's in here? Like he's in here. And like talking to me at the same time, he's like, he's in here because he's a drug addict. And if we give him a direct line to his heart, he's going to die like immediately. And I fully intended on doing that.
That was your plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Completely intended on doing that.
So even though you hadn't used in over 2 months, mm-hmm. you were just waiting for that opportunity.
Right. And it was, you know, and then I got out of the, I finally did get out of the hospital and I ended up having to take pill form of the, you know, the antibiotics because they removed that deep
Rightfully
stent.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I, after that, you know, it was weird because I'd been okay. Like I wanted to go to rehab, but at the same time I had this like other thought in my brain where it was almost like a reactionary thing where I just took those like as like a standby, like, well, I have this, so I might as well use it, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew that I'd be going and that I ended up going to an IOP in Chicago, Hazleton, their program in Chicago, right after I got out of the hospital. And great program. And I went there, did it, you know, for a few months. I ended up using they sent me up to their Minnesota rehab clinic. And I went up there for, I don't know, whatever. It was 30 days, one of the many places I went. And I left there. Came back, used again, went to another place, used again, you know, and then that went on. And this was 2013 when all the surgeries happened. So I went through that pattern again where I started going back. And I actually did stupidly. I have a little scar right there, which was the mark that I tried to use again. I tried to shoot into my reconstructed arm.
Oh.
Which like – and thankfully –
Which is really not your arm. It's your thigh.
No, it's my thigh, yeah. My thigh circa – yeah, yeah.
So in and out of those, and how did you get to Utah?
So it was a few more years of that process, I guess you'd call it. Now it would be about 5 years ago. I got into Xanax for the first time and was combining the Xanax and heroin. And 2000, on my mom's birthday, actually, April 28th. Yeah, 28th, 2017, I was arrested in what it was a case of mistaken identity with the DEA, where they were looking for a kid that matched my description, had my same car, driving into Inglewood in Chicago, which is the bad side.
Did he have his thigh on his forearm too?
No, he didn't. No. I wish they would have been able to tell me apart that way. Yeah. I should have that on my driver's license. And, you know, and I'd gotten arrested then. I mean, it was a mistaken identity in the case. It wasn't who they wanted, but I was picking up drugs. So they, you know, rightfully arrested
me. They'll
count it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they weren't happy about it, but, you know, they arrested me. And then I was on house arrest for about a month. Well, it was exactly a month. Got off, and this would have been like May 2017. I went back out and used, and I was prescribed Xanax at the time. I was actually prescribed 4 bars, so 4 2-milligram Xanax a day, which
is a lot.
Is outrageous.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, and it was, and the thing is, it was so easy too. You know, I just went into a doctor and said, "Hey, my old guy's off my insurance policy, or not in my insurance network anymore. And this is what I was on." And you know, just that's another story. But it was so simple, and I started taking Xanax again. I mean, not again, but I started taking Xanax. Went to the doctor, and I went back and started using again. And I remember it was the Home Run Derby 2017, because I watched, I think it was Giancarlo Stanton go bat. And then the next thing I remembered was waking up in the back of an ambulance. And what had happened was I'd used, after not using in a while, and like an idiot, I always prided myself as like a smart drug addict. Like, well, I've never OD'd, so, you know, I know not to jump right back into using. But the thing was, the combination of Xanax and heroin was so powerful that it had basically killed me for, you know, it was about 30-minute period where I was out. And my sister had walked in my room, which is something like that to this day. Like, every time I think about it, it's just like, it kills me, because the situation of what happened. She walked into my room, and like, it was one of those like miracle moments again, where she like, not that we didn't see each other all the time, but like, it was a rare thing for her to just kind of like, she just had a whim to come in and checked on me. And then they called 911, and obviously I'm out for all this, but I wake up in the back of an ambulance, and you know, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, what is happening right now? And you know, and they're just kind of like, relax, relax, relax. And literally my first thought, my first like cognizant thought that I can remember was, let's get this over with, because I still have more in my room. And I want to go back. That's the only thing I could remember. Like, that's my first memory of waking up. And I went to, so I go to the hospital. You know, all my family shows up and everything. And I was like, I was feeling down my leg, because my leg was like cocked. And what happened was, because I was out so long, because my blood flow had been like so reduced, and because of the fact that I have bad veins, but mainly because of the fact that I'd been, you know, quote unquote dead, whatever, for so long, they had to do a deep bone stint. So, or bone marrow stint. Mm-hmm. So what it is like, it's like an 8-gauge needle. It's like a really thick needle. It's like really a screw.
Right.
And they screw it into your bone, because like, from what I was explained, it's like your last flowing, living,
right,
like, you know, able to get through the rest of your body. And I woke up with that, and I was like, what the hell is this? And even the one nurse was just like, I've never seen that. I don't know what that is. And I was a little concerned, because I was in the ER and she didn't know what it was. But then, you know, then they explained it to me, and came in and told me what had happened. Like I said, my family showed up, and being out for so long, I was in this weird situation where I didn't, you know, all my faculties weren't back yet. Like, I wasn't quite there. And like, I just remember, like, I don't know if, whatever you want to call it, like, you know, whether it was like getting in touch with God, or however you want to phrase it, it was like something that like had touched me. And I heard you say earlier, the CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy. I started going to see a therapist in Chicago, mm-hmm. Dr. Teresa Albini. And I don't know if she's a doctor or not, but anyway, I started going to see her, and right before this overdose, I started to see her. And after the overdose, and she was amazing. Like, she called me that night and, you know, was like just truly cared. Like, it was like 11 o'clock at night, and she's like talking me through all this stuff. And I can't remember which one of my family members, but had heard of a place out here, out in Utah. And she'd heard of the same place because she'd seen them at some kind of convention or something like that. So she, you know, said, you should go out there. So I went out, checked that, you know, and I came out. It would have been July or June, the end of June 2017 is when I first came out. Went out up to the lodge up in
Provo Canyon?
No, up in Big Cottonwood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And went there, went through it. Got through it, and you know, it was an amazing experience. I mean, I loved it. It was almost like coming out to Utah was almost the same experience as going to the Scientology rehab. It's like I saw pictures of the place, and I was like, yeah, I want to go there because of the scenery, basically. But also, in a way, it was, you know, I'd come to a certain, I don't know, realization, whatever, you know, it's epiphany that I needed something. Came out, went through it, you know, met a lot of really cool people, met Frank, went to sober living down in Kaysville, and I lived there for, I don't know, about a year. I'd say it was about a year, and then June 18th of 2018. Well, it was a couple days before that, but you know, like relapsed, and then at this point, Dustin had started working with the program with. And I'd started to see some of the people, like it was kind of intermixed, the sober living we were at, where it was like the people where I was, and then also war at the time.
Yeah.
And like it was crazy because like another one of my good friends, Wes, who was one of my roommates there, you know, we'd see him come back. Like they'd go do a different program, and they'd go come back then in the afternoon, and we'd see him, like, you know, everybody left the same kind of, you know, dazed, miserable, waking up at 7 o'clock, like, oh, I don't want to do this. But come back like in the highest spirits, you know what I mean? Just like confident, like just had obviously I had a great time. And for the first year I was there, it was probably like the last 6 months that I was in sober living before the relapse in June 2018. Like I noticed that's when they intermixed it. And then when I relapsed, they mixed the programs. So then I started getting into it. And that's when I first met Dustin. And like I'd known Frank and Wes, who they're my best friends to today, right now. And they, you know, we started going through the program, and what I noticed was getting, how do I explain it? Getting a certain level of comfort and confidence in myself that I hadn't, you know, that I hadn't had before. And I'd been to so many of the rehabs before, and I don't begrudge any of that because I picked up a lot of information from each one of them. And each one of them, like, I feel to this day I still use certain aspects. But it was almost like nothing ever – there was never, like, a confluence of all of it together.
I say something clicked.
Yes, exactly.
Something clicked in you that this felt right. This felt at home. And this was my community, and this is where I can grow. And I think that's what we really want from everybody out there. You know, when you get into recovery, people often come to me and say, hey, Casey, what are you doing? I go, I'm doing what works for me, and it makes sense for me. It might work for you, and it might not. It's not a one-size-fits-all, and I think you're a perfect example of that because you've been to 12 different rehabs. You've been in and out of different programs, but you found something that made sense to you.
Exactly.
And the thing I really love about you is that you didn't give up.
Yeah.
And you kept moving forward because there were so many times you were telling your story and I was thinking, this is where it ends. This is where it ends. This has got to be where it ends. Holy cow. This
there
isn't
can't
where
be
it ends.
Anymore.
But it ends with you working out with Dustin Hawkins in the SOAR program up in Ogden. And you found a community that's really given you what you need, and you're giving it back. And you're doing that by sharing your story today, which I think is probably one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. I mean, I was looking at Josh, our producer's face. I was looking at your face. And there was probably 7 to 8 WTF moments.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not kidding you. I was like,
easily.
Holy, what? You know, and I thought we've heard a lot on this podcast.
Well, we have, but I mean, this is a perfect example of just, I mean, how powerful an addiction can be. It's just, I mean, you lived through just having this iron grip around your ability to make choices for yourself. It changed completely how you think. Your brain was just looking for that next opportunity. How is it different now, today? Like, how do you think? Do you think differently? Are you still tempted every day? What's it like?
No, you know, it's weird. I definitely think differently. And coming up on the 18th, which I don't know when. What's the date? Is today the 18th?
Today.
Oh, today's 2 years. I didn't even know. Right. High five, man. That's crazy. That's awesome.
I thought it was
the 12th. Today's 2 years.
Yeah.
I swear to God, I didn't plan that.
No, because we asked you here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's nuts. But it is. It's like, obviously, you know, I still like, you know, like I think one of Dustin's terms is like walking through the shadows. Like I still walk through the shadows, you know, and I think it'll be a constant life struggle, whatever, however you want to put it. But it was, it's the fact that I have, like you said, community, you know, and I heard earlier you said the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And that's what I have, is like a connection. And I know I have the tools. I know I have the ability. You know, I mean, obviously the gym is a big part of it. Working out, gaining confidence from learning how Dustin's favorite thing is working with a barbell, learning how to move a barbell, and learning how to exercise in some of the different lifts and the different training programs, which is great. I mean, those are phenomenal things because, you know, you get body composition, physically you feel better, but the nutrition aspect is just as big. And I would say the biggest part by far is the spiritual aspect of it. I mean, without that, you know, something like we talk about a lot is like, if you get injured, if you hurt yourself and you can't train for, you know, a few months or something, like you lose that whole foundation. But with the spiritual program, it's like this net that's below it, that like if that crumbles, you still get caught by it. And you have this, I don't know, the like I said, the camaraderie that comes with it, and like the group mentality we have. You know, we go on these amazing hikes. We went on one, it was more of a climb. It was mountain climb because we got lost on a trail and ended up having to climb up a mountain. And it was pretty precarious for a while. It was pretty scary, but like it was one of those things. We got to the top and like we're hugging each other, like we're having like the greatest time ever, you know. And it's like the student to coach aspect of it, where, you know, people go through it, see the benefits they have, and then immediately recognize that like the largest benefit is giving back, is the service part of it, is bringing in a new guy or new girl that comes in, is lost. You've been in that situation. You know, like you can see it in their eyes, you know, even if they're even looking you in the eyes. Cause a lot, you know, for me, it took me a long time before I looked people in the eyes, cause I had so much shame. And it's recognizing that and getting to a point where once you see them starting to look up and you see them starting to kind of like walk with their shoulders back and you see them starting to just,
you see the life coming back.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I love that. I got one more question before we let you go, but I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing your story. This is definitely one for the books. And the SOAR program up in Ogden doing wonderful things. We'll have a link at the bottom of this. So if you want to go check them out and see what they're all about, we appreciate it. We want to say thank you for stopping by and listening to our podcast today. Dr. Matt, any last words?
I mean, just add my thank you to your honesty and being willing to open up and share. I mean, you're in a position to help so many people and inspire so many people. And so I really appreciate that. I'm on the professional side of these things, but I don't think at least in the area of addiction recovery, professionals aren't enough. We need people who are in recovery to help kind of spread that word and provide that support. So thank you.
My last question for you is simple. Do you believe in miracles?
Yes. L. Michaels.
Yeah, he does. I love it. We can't end in a better way. You're listening to Project Recovery, brought to you by our friends at useonlyasdirected.org. They got a three-part solution: speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
The contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.